Welcome to Artrageous, a weekly podcast about the truly outrageous stories in the art and design world. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Artrageous. As much fun as I've had working on the AI topics the last couple of weeks, I am very excited to finally turn the page on all of that and get back into some of the stuff that really is the bread and butter of what this show is about. And that's talking about some of the weird and wild and crazy stories of the art and design world. Looking back at my episode list, I find it really funny and, to be honest, maybe a bit strategic that about every 3 or 4 episodes, I try to bring a true crime type of episode to the table. That's really just because I find these stories to be so much fun. I love a good old whodunit, and in the case of the kleptomaniac collector where we knew the who, I also like a good old howdunit, I guess you would call it. Sometimes we focus on a specific person doing the thieving, sometimes it's on a specific piece that was stolen, but this week we're going to focus on the second option there and take a look at a piece that I would say is pretty well known. We're talking about The Scream by Edvard Munch. The Scream is undoubtedly Munch's most famous painting, and I don't know why, but I always assume that really famous and expensive art pieces have really fancy titles, so I've always been skeptical of the actual name of the painting. Like, is that just a nickname that's just so synonymous with the painting that it's stuck, and we still call it that today, even though it has another name entirely? Or is it really just that simply named? Well, since Edvard Munch is a Norwegian painter, the painting was named in Norwegian, and please forgive me as I butcher this pronunciation, but it was named Skirk, which literally translates to shriek in English. It also has a German title under which it was first exhibited, which I am also going to probably pronounce incorrectly, but it was called Der Schrei der Natur, which translates to the scream of nature. So I was kind of right in that the painting had other more fancy names, but really at the same time, this somewhat odd painting has pretty much always been known as The Scream. And yes, I did just call it a somewhat odd painting because I always looked at the figure and thought that it was an alien or something. Maybe it's the big bald head, long lanky body and greenish skin, or maybe I'm just blind and don't understand proto-expressionism paintings. But the origin of the painting comes from when Munch was out for a walk during sunset. His journal entry from January 22, 1892 reads, "One evening I was walking along a path. The city was on one side and the fjord below. I felt tired and ill. I stopped and looked out over the fjord. The sun was setting and the clouds were turning blood red. I sensed a scream passing through nature. It seemed to me that I heard the scream. I painted this picture. Painted the clouds as actual blood. The color shrieked. This became The Scream." He later described his inspiration for the image by saying, "I was walking along the road with two friends. The sun was setting. Suddenly the sky turned blood red. I paused, feeling exhausted, and leaned on the fence. There was blood and tongues of fire above the blue-black fjord in the city. My friends walked on, and I stood there trembling with anxiety. And I sensed an infinite scream passing through nature." Reading that, it makes sense now and explains the two creepy, black, shadowy figures in the background. They must have been the two friends that were walking on and not actually like Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones from Men in Black coming to take care of the alien man. So scholars have since found the exact location Munch was referencing, which is a fjord overlooking Oslo, Norway. And if you don't know what a fjord is, don't worry, I had to look it up too. It's basically a long, narrow inlet with steep sides or cliffs created by a glacier. They exist all over the world, including the state of Washington here in the U.S. This fun fact says that Norway's coastline is about 18,000 miles or 29,000 kilometers long and has almost 1,200 fjords. Which, while I'm here tangenting, the Norwegian coastline would only be about 1,600 miles or 2,500 kilometers without all those long, narrow inlets, which is about 8% of the actual coastline that would be a nightmare for housing and real estate sales. Thank you, Wikipedia, for the fun facts and for distracting me from the point of this episode. Scholars also think that there are a couple reasons for the sky being bright red. One of the proposed theories is a psychological reaction by Monk to a nearby slaughterhouse and also his sister being committed to a nearby lunatic asylum. But the other reason I found was super interesting, and it's that Monk seeing the red sky could be a result of a volcanic eruption. Geographically and time periodly speaking, there's a very famous volcano named Krakatoa located near Indonesia that erupted super violently in 1883. It started out with lots of big earthquakes that reached as far as Australia, and then in May 1883, it started to spew ash and make scary loud noises. This early phase, as they call it, went on for months until it reached what's known as the climactic phase around August 25th, 1883. And when it finally erupted, one of its lasting effects was that it darkened skies around the world for years afterwards and produced some spectacular sunsets around the world for many months after the eruption. This is how a volcanic eruption in Indonesia could create stunning red sunsets about 8,000 miles away in Norway in November of 1883. So yeah, the painting that I thought was a dock along a beachy coastline at sunset is actually a towering canyon of doom covered by a blood-red volcanic sky. No wonder the figure in the painting is screaming. There's a lot of other scholarly stuff I found when researching that isn't quite as entertaining, so I'm going to skip over a lot of it. But I think I'll quickly talk about this next thing because it kind of loops into these actual heists, and hopefully I can do a decent job of explaining my thought process here. So one thing you might not know about the Scream, and I didn't know this either until researching, is that there's actually more than one version of the painting. There's four. Two are paintings and two are pastel drawings. The first painted version from 1893 is about 36 inches tall by 29 inches wide and is painted with tempera paints on cardboard. That's insane. Cardboard is one of the most insanely fragile art surfaces I would never think to seriously paint on. I know there's a big part of the art world that uses found objects to create art, and there's a big stigma that good art is only created using expensive, high-quality materials, but wow. Cardboard? That has to be a conservator's nightmare in terms of preservation. But yeah, there's the first painted version from 1893 that's in the collection of the National Gallery of Norway in Oslo. What's funny about this version is that it has some faint writing in pencil that says, "Kan kun ver malet af en gal mand," which is my terrible pronunciation of Norwegian, meaning could only have been painted by a madman, which is absolutely amazing. This painting also notably has some wax on it from a candle that I guess Monk had knocked over or something, or there was an accident, and the candle wax was splattered on the painting and was just never removed. There's also a pastel version of The Scream from 1893 that is theorized to have been almost like a preliminary study for that 1893 painting. That one is currently in the collection of the Munch Museum, which is also in Oslo. Then there's the second pastel version from 1895 that was owned by a German-Jewish art collector named Hugo Simon. He sold it to a Norwegian ship owner named Thomas Olsen sometime around 1937. But I'm sure no matter what he sold it for, he's now rolling over in his grave after it sold at auction for $119,922,600 at Sotheby's Impressionist and Modern Art Auction in May of 2012. His heirs actually contested the sale, claiming that the painting was stolen from him by the Nazis during World War II. We discussed this topic a bit in the very first episode of Artrageous, but there's a lot of touchy stuff going on with Nazi-looted art in the whole restitution process, so I found this side story to be really interesting. You know, maybe we can dig into that a bit more another day. But more on the topic of The Scream, there's then the second painted version from 1910 that was created during a period when Monk revisited some of his prior works. That one is also in the collection of the Munch Museum in Oslo. So those are the four main versions, and then somehow there are still more versions. The Munch Museum has eight versions on display. So the two I just mentioned, and then there are six other lithographs from 1895. Okay, so there's four notable versions of The Scream. When we think of this famous painting, which version is the most notorious? That would actually be the 1893 painting on cardboard. It's so popular that it was also featured as the cover illustration for a book on psychological disorder and art published in 1908. Of the two Scream paintings, both of them have been stolen. The first painting was stolen first in 1994, and the second painting was stolen second in 2004. So not only do we have one good heist to talk about, but we actually have two to discuss. Both are pretty interesting, so it was hard to choose one over the other. But as Miguel Antulio from the 2000 animated movie The Road to El Dorado would say, both. Both is good. As I wrap up this section of the episode, I feel like it might be kind of remiss of me not to talk about the artist himself for a quick minute, at least as it pertains to the art. High-level overview, Munch was born in Norway on December 12, 1863. He was often ill as a child, which would keep him out of school, so he would draw to keep himself occupied. Looking at his home life and his journal entries, he wrote, "My father was temperamentally nervous and obsessively religious, to the point of psychoneurosis. From him, I inherited the seeds of madness. The angels of fear, sorrow, and death stood by my side since the day I was born." That's just absolutely horrible to hear that. And from what I'm reading, I think a lot of Munch's mental state can be attributed to his childhood with the oppressive religious environment and his poor physical health. Unfortunately, even one of his sisters was also diagnosed with mental health at an early age. So it sounds like there was a lot going on that really helps inform the context for the vision and the creation of the Scream as we know it today. Some other notes here. He went to a technical college to study engineering, but frequent illnesses kind of put a pause on his studies. He later enrolled in an art school in 1881, where he began studying art and experimented with many different styles. But I think it's kind of easy to see how Impressionism inspired a lot of Munch's works. He lived in Paris and Berlin, which is how The Scream was first displayed in Germany in 1893. The Scream itself is widely interpreted as representing the universal anxiety of modern man, and with this painting, Munch met his stated goal of the study of the soul, that is to say, the study of my own self. The Scream is just such an iconic and incredible piece the more you look at it. From the sheer fact that it was painted on cardboard, of all things, to looking at the deeper meaning, it is a really cool piece. It might not be something that I would hang in my house, but it's still pretty cool. And I think it's that popularity that drew the attention of so many people and probably what led to it being the target of not one, but two heists. More on that when we come back. Welcome back, everyone. I think we are finally ready to get into the true crime part of this story and talk about what actually happened to The Scream all the way back in 1994, which I can't believe I'm saying the words all the way back in 1994 because that's the year I was born. So maybe effectively I'm calling myself old, but whatever. It's fine. The backdrop for this story is the 1994 Winter Olympics held in Norway. Leading up to the big event, Norway's National Museum had moved their version of The Scream from its usual location to a ground floor gallery as part of a showcase of Norwegian culture. Now, this may sound like a good idea, but in hindsight, it was a pretty controversial move. If you think about a museum, what area would you think would be the hardest to secure? Where do you think is the most foot traffic? Maybe a cafeteria or gift shop? That wouldn't be a bad guess, but the busiest part of a museum is the first floor. There's entrances and exits, people walking around and through to get to all parts of the museum, and if there's windows, then they're probably roughly on street level where windows are relatively within reach. But there's security staff, alarm systems, and security cameras, right? Surely no one would think that they could get away with a heist of the most well-known painting in the entire museum with all that in place, right? Well, about that. Clearly, the gallery was mistaken when they thought that all of those security measures would be enough to protect The Scream from would-be thieves. At 6:30 a.m. on February 12, 1994, the same day of the opening ceremony of the Olympics, the museum's alarm went off. Gallery guards immediately called the police, and they arrived within minutes. But somehow, they were already too late. So much for the guards and the alarms. But what about the security cameras? Keep in mind, this was 1994 when security camera quality wasn't all that great, but the police did take a look at the security cameras, and when they did, they saw two men climb up a ladder that was propped against the wall outside the gallery window. After smashing the window, they climbed through it, cut the screen off the wall using wire cutters, and took the painting back out the window, down a ladder, and then disappeared down the street. All of this happened within just 50 seconds. Let's think about this for a minute. I'll include pictures in the show notes so you can see what I'm talking about, but this ladder looks to be about 20 feet long, and it's not one of those fancy collapsible ladders, so to me, it would be really weird to see two guys carrying a 20-ish foot ladder through the city, unless there was some construction nearby that could possibly explain it. Then the gallery window is maybe 12, 15 feet off the ground, and it looks to be a single pane window that would be pretty easy to break. There's a window below it that has metal bars on it, which is probably like a more street level basement type room, but the gallery window they went through was pretty high up. The ladder was propped up against the building directly by the window, and it looks like it would be pretty easy to climb, so that's fine. But to smash the window, go into the gallery, cut the painting with wire cutters, and here's where I'm amazed. They then carried this painting that's like 36 by 29 inches, so it's not a small painting. Plus, I'm sure it had a frame that added some weight, and it also looks like it has a backing, so it wasn't just the cardboard that the painting was painted on. So that means that they're trying to maneuver this big, chunky painting down a sketchy, skinny metal ladder, and then they go on their merry way, leaving the ladder in the process. Well, I guess if you have a priceless painting, and admittedly, I can only find the price of the $120 million 1895 pastel version, I'm going to assume the painting itself is worth more. But if you have a painting worth that much in your hands, then I guess you could afford to leave behind a ladder. But okay, they get away with this painting. Well, what are they planning on doing with it? We saw this a little when the Mona Lisa was stolen in 1911, but if you have such a high-profile piece of art, you aren't going to be able to turn around and sell it to any reputable art dealer or by any legal or normal means because the piece is just too hot. There's too many eyes looking for it. Even if you wait years for a piece like that, the hype would never die down and you'd be left sitting on a piece that you couldn't flip for profit. You know, even though the thieves may have been lacking a few brain cells in that department, at least they weren't lacking a sense of humor. Before leaving the gallery with the painting, the thieves left a postcard behind that says, "Thanks for the poor security," which I find absolutely hilarious to the point that I made it the title of the entire episode. Okay, so you're a museum staffer who just realized that the most valuable item in the entire museum was just stolen. What do you do? Well, apparently the museum's director realized the same things that I just said and made a statement to the press stating that the Scream was Norway's most valuable and Munch's most renowned painting and that it would be impossible to sell. Add 1 point for Carrie for thinking ahead of what I was researching. But yeah, regardless of how the movies portray art heists, experts know that stolen paintings are nearly unsellable. While a legit legal version of the painting would go for hundreds of millions of dollars in the art market, a stolen version is virtually worthless and is probably more trouble than it's worth. So if there was no resale market for the stolen painting, then why was it stolen? Thinking about location and timing, this theft happened the same day as the opening ceremonies of the Winter Olympics that were being held just over 2 hours north of Oslo near the city of Lillehammer. There's a lot of people in the country and a lot of foreigners as well. So maybe the timing wasn't a coincidence? A lot of people speculated that maybe the theft was some kind of publicity stunt. And that would make sense considering there was a radical anti-abortion group that claimed responsibility for the theft, but that claim was quickly dismissed by the police, who saw them as nothing more than attention seekers. So really, the police had nothing to go on. They didn't have much in the way of motive, and they definitely didn't have much in the way of evidence. When researching, I didn't see that there were any witness statements, so I'm going to assume that any witnesses weren't of much help or just didn't make that big of an impact. Even the postcard left behind wasn't much use for things like fingerprint evidence. If the thieves were first-time offenders, their fingerprints wouldn't be in the system. And if their fingerprints were in the system, then there's the chance that they weren't matched to anyone and were just logged as part of another crime scene. But even then, fingerprint evidence and fingerprint analysis relies on a database. And to be honest, I'm not sure how the Norwegian police system works and how connected the different cities were in 1994. And beyond that, if we look at an organization like Interpol and their international fingerprint database, AFIS, which is the Automatic Fingerprint Identification System, I have no clue how widely used or accessible that was in 94 in Norway. And that's assuming there even were any matches in that database. So yeah, the police really didn't have anything to go on, and they were just kind of left to sit there on their hands until some new evidence came up or some new key witness stepped forward. They really just needed something to happen and provide a break in the case. Well, apparently, the thieves realized what we've been saying all along, and they realized that there wasn't much that they could do with this painting. 1 month after the theft, on March 3rd, 1994, the National Gallery received a ransom letter. The thieves had demanded $1 million for the return of the painting. Naturally, the gallery refused to pay this ransom. I'm going to guess it was mostly out of principle, but probably also because they didn't want to pay that much because there was no proof of authenticity for the information or that they were paying for the real painting that they wanted back. For all they knew, it could be a scam where the people who wrote the ransom note don't even have the painting and are just trying to extort money. Or maybe they're buying a fake. $1 million is just too much money to be throwing out in blind hopes of getting this painting back. The gallery then turned to the British Police's Arts and Antiquities Squad for help. With the new information and a way to contact the potential thieves, the Norwegian and British police came up with a joint sting operation to try to catch their targets and recover the painting. A lot of the articles I was finding when researching were very vague about this portion of the story. They really just say that two undercover officers offered to buy the painting for about $250,000, which is a mere quarter of the price demanded in the original ransom note, but the thieves accepted the offer and they got the painting back. Luckily, when written articles fail for me for research, videos and YouTube are here to save the day. I found a video on YouTube from BBC News that's a brief segment, just under 4 minutes, where they interviewed an art detective named Charles Hill, who was one of the men who went undercover to retrieve the painting. Here's a slightly abridged version of what he had to say about it in the video titled, How I Recovered the Scream.
At Scotland Yard, on the Monday, we came up with a plan. Just pose as the representatives of the J. Paul Getty Museum in California and tell these guys there's money to be had if they'll give us the picture back. The character I came up with, Chris Roberts, was a slightly dodgy, mid-Atlantic accented art dealer who was doing some buying for the Getty Museum in Europe. What we did in this particular case was to go from a person who knew someone else, and just followed that chain until we eventually got to the people who controlled the painting. When I finally met the bad guys, I had to convince them that the Getty Museum would pay to recover the painting. The Norwegian criminals were on tenterhooks, and I spent the entire time trying to calm them down. And eventually they rang me quite late, about 11:30, I would guess it was, that night in my room, and said, right, we're going to do it now. And I told them I was no way I was going out at midnight to walk in the wild woods with them to get this thing back. We'd have to do it in the morning. In the morning, we went down to where the dodgy art dealer had a summer house. In the summer house, the painting was downstairs underneath the carpet in the kitchen with a set of stairs down to the basement. And Ulvin asked me, did I want to get it? And I thought, well, I could do without being down there next Christmas. So I told him that. And so he went down and got the picture, brought it up, and he laid it on the dining room table, and bang, there was the picture. I knew the picture was right straight away because I checked the wax, and it looked like it. A masterpiece will tell you itself that it's a masterpiece. It just jumps out at you. I rang back to Oslo, told them I had it, barricaded myself in the hotel. Sure enough, after an hour or so, the central detective unit in Oslo turned up and I unbarricaded the room and there was the picture.
Wow, that's definitely a story to tell the grandkids. I love to hear firsthand accounts of these types of things because it's just so cool to hear it from the person who actually experienced the thing. And to be honest, articles get boring when you're looking at so many of them and trying to figure out what really happened from a third-party source that might have their facts wrong. So thank you to BBC News' YouTube channel for that really cool storytime interview. What Charles Hill didn't talk about in that video was the actual arrest of the thieves who did it, and why. He mentioned that the painting was recovered in like a hotel, beach resort, summer house type location. This location was ironically pretty fitting since Munch had owned a cottage in the area and painted many of his famous works there. In total, four men were arrested and convicted of theft and attempting to sell stolen artwork. The leader of the group was a man named Paul Enger. Before being the ringleader for this heist, he was a former pro soccer player who had already spent 4 years in prison in the late 1980s for the theft of another Munch artwork called Vampire, also known as Love and Pain. Yep, he was a serial thief. I'll admit, when I started researching the story of the Scream heist, I did not expect there to be a criminal art-stealing mastermind in the mix. I guess I just thought it would be some random person that saw an opportunity and decided to steal the painting, but I do love to be pleasantly surprised, and this did not disappoint. Apparently, when Paul Enger wasn't running around on a soccer field or scoring a goal in a stadium, he was out scoring in other ways through heists. When the police raided his home the first time in the 1980s, they found evidence tying him to a jewelry heist in Oslo. You would think that diamonds, expensive watches, and wads of cash would be enough to pique the interest of police, but they found even more. During the raid, they found Munch's 1893 vampire painting just casually hanging on Enger's wall. At the time of the police raid, the painting had been stolen from the Munch Museum in Oslo just a few months earlier. So yeah, he definitely did some prison time for that one. You would think that maybe he would have learned his lesson from that four-year prison sentence. I mean, his openness about his crimes was what got the police's attention in the first place. But apparently, after getting out of jail, he chose to go back to the life of a criminal rather than playing professional soccer. Enger was one of the two men that had climbed through the gallery window and stolen the Scream in 1994. And if you were wondering how he knew that the painting had been moved to such an accessible location for a thief to steal, then you might not be surprised that, like most thieves, Enger had cased the place 5 days before the heists and was actually caught on security camera taking a look at the security situation. So we now know the what, the who, the when, and the how, but we're still missing the why for this story. Why would someone steal the Scream if they knew it would be more trouble than it was worth to try and sell and make money? I mean, maybe he didn't realize how hard the painting would be to sell. Maybe it was just him wanting to show that he could steal one of the world's most famous paintings after seeing how easy it would be. Police eventually realized that the heist was a calculated plan devised by a small group of criminals who also conducted a couple bank thefts in the weeks after the Scream was stolen. Once the four Scream thieves were caught, Enger was sentenced to a little over 6 years in prison. He did escape at one point while on a prison field trip, but his stolen freedom was very short-lived when he was captured just 12 days later wearing a blonde wig and dark sunglasses while trying to buy a train ticket to Copenhagen. Another slightly bizarre twist to the Enger story is that after he was released in the year 2000, I guess he decided to start frequenting art auctions because he managed to purchase a Munch lithograph by legitimate means rather than stealing it. But he wasn't completely living life on the straight and narrow because eventually he found himself back in prison after being charged with 19 offenses, anything from driving without a license to stealing a taxi sign and two pairs of socks. The other three accomplices, surprisingly, did not see much jail time. The conviction of those three were overturned during an appeal process because of a legal technicality. It turns out that the detectives working the case had entered Norway using false identities, which is a violation of Norwegian law. To be clear, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think it was because they used fake names in the investigation itself when they went to meet up with the dealers. The problem was that they originally entered the country using fake names. I guess by entering the country in a way that violated Norwegian law, that somehow rendered the arrest void? I mean, I'm not sure on that one, but I'll admit I'm not an expert on legal stuff, let alone Norwegian legal stuff. So we're not saying that the three guys who were released were innocent. They just got off pretty much scot-free because of a technicality. Which is kind of funny and also a bummer at the same time, since I feel like they probably should have faced a little bit more consequence for their actions. In the end, the Scream was recovered and returned to the National Gallery in Oslo, where I'm gonna guess it now has a little bit better security to protect it. I don't think there was much in the way of any damage to the painting, so that's some good news too. I think if there's anything that we've learned from this 1893 Scream heist, and even from the Mona Lisa theft we talked about a while back, is that it's probably going to be a bit difficult to offload or sell a super high profile, ridiculously famous painting. But yeah, that's the story of the 1893 Scream heist. That was actually a lot more than I expected to get into for that portion of this episode. There's actually a whole second half to this story because the Scream was stolen not once, but twice. But technically, as I think we mentioned earlier, it was the other version of the painting that was stolen the second time. But you know what I mean. And I'll admit, maybe it was a bit of a pipe dream, for me to think that I would be able to get through both heists in one episode. But if you can forgive me for my bad puns and terrible time management skills when it comes to storytelling, then I'm hoping you might forgive me for breaking this story into two parts. The good news is that you don't have to wait too long, though, because I have part two of this story coming your way next week. Keep your podcast app notifications turned on to be notified when the Scream Heist Part 2 is released next Thursday here on Artrageous. I'll be working really hard on that episode for you guys and on some other stuff I have in the works. So until then, stay Artrageous. Series music created by Arensen. Music and transition sounds licensed from Motion Array. Artrageous is a proud partner of Stoveleg Media.
Stoveleg Media. Igniting conversation.